Hello.
Hello.
Hi, Jean.
Hey, hi, Howard.
How are you?
Fine. The recording is already starting.
Yes, I know.
Okay.
So when these get put on, I assume we edit the introductory stuff, right? Does that happen? We don't know.
No, not on the recordings. But I'll see what I can do about editing that.
Okay. All right, no problem. Can you hear me okay, Jeannie?
Yes, I can.
Okay, good.
Actually, you're a little bit faint.
Is it better now?
Uh-huh.
Okay. I'll closer to the phone. I'm on.
Okay.
Jean?
Yeah.
At the end, just send me an email because I'm not in front of a computer with the numbers.
Sure. Oh, okay.
I'm not in front of a computer.
Okay.
Hello.
Good morning. This is Jeannie.
Hi, Jeannie. It's Lori.
Oh, hi, Lori.
How are you doing?
Fine. maybe we can talk after the telebrief.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay.
Everybody out there, Howard Kerman. We'll get started in a couple minutes.
Hello. Good morning, Howard.
Hey.
Good morning.
How are you?
Are we just waiting to get started?
Good morning, Howard. It's Ann.
Hey, Ann. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Doing well, thank you.
Are you in Baltimore today?
I'm in Baltimore until about 10 o'clock when I have to go to Philadelphia.
Gotcha.
Howard, you're a little bit faint.
I'll take it off the speakerphone. Is that better?
Okay, much better.
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
For me too.
Okay, good. All right, we'll say 2 minutes and we will get started. One more minute and we will be off. All right, we're going to get started. Good morning to everybody. This is Howard Kerman, This is our twice a month telebrief, labor and employment telebrief. If anybody is on the phone for the first time, welcome aboard. Those of you who are regulars, also welcome. There is plenty to talk about today, and a lot of it emanates from the Supreme Court of all places. So I'm going to address a couple of those developments in some detail because I think they're very significant from an employer's or company standpoint. The first thing that I wanted to mention, and I know that I mentioned this a couple of telebriefs ago, is that the Supreme Court has, in fact, agreed to accept the Canning case for review. And as those of you who have heard me talk about this before, the Canning case was essentially a decision by the Court of Appeals in the D.C. Circuit, which held that the Obama recess appointments to the Labor Board in January 2012, three of which were made by the president at that time, were invalid. And the D.C. Circuit was joined by the Third Circuit, which includes Philadelphia. And so it was no surprise to me that the Supreme Court agreed to hear this case, a very significant case, in October. The reason that it's significant is for a couple reasons. One is because it will test the validity or lack of validity of so-called presidential recess appointments. So this not only applies to the National Labor Relations Board, but it applies to other governmental agencies as well when the president is making so-called recess appointments. More practically for you all and for employers that have anything to do with the National Labor Relations Board, which is almost any employer in the country, there have been a series of decisions, as you know, from the beginning of 2012 and to the present time, where the constituency of the Labor Board will be thrown into question depending on what the Supreme Court does with this case. And there could be a whole series of cases decided by the National Labor Relations Board which are in fact invalidated if the Supreme Court decides that the Obama so-called recess appointments were invalid when made in January of 2012. So oral arguments on this case will be heard in the October term. We will not get a decision, I am sure, until sometime in the May-June timeframe in 2014, which throws much of what the Labor Board has done in the last year and a half into question. But nevertheless, it's no surprise that the Supreme Court has agreed to hear this case, and we'll just have to hold on and see how the Supreme Court comes down on this, and I'll keep you informed, particularly when briefs are filed, which I will read and then try and translate into English for everybody prior to the time that the Supreme Court even holds oral argument on this. The next Supreme Court case that I want to talk about is a very, very significant case that was decided June 24th. So in terms of timely topics for the telebrief, we can't get more topical than this. And this is a case called Vance versus Ball State University. Some of you may have heard me talk about this previously. Essentially, it has to do with the standard by which an employee must prove workplace harassment on the part of an employer and who is considered to be a supervisor when an act of harassment is allegedly committed by somebody in a management chain. Very briefly, this involves Ball State University and an employee at Ball State University who claimed that she was the victim of workplace harassment by somebody that she perceived to be her supervisor. Now, just by way of background, so you all know, under traditional and well-settled Supreme Court law, workplace harassment is actionable if it is done by a co-employee towards another employee. So in other words, a non-supervisory employee harasses another non-supervisory employee. The employer is liable in that situation only if it was negligent in controlling those working conditions. That is, even if the harassment took place, the employer would only be able to be found liable if it knew or should have known that some act of harassment was going on and yet didn't take affirmative steps to do anything about it. So again, where you have a rank and file employee committing an alleged act of workplace harassment or sexual harassment against another rank and file employee, that employee can only prove liability under traditional Supreme Court law if that employee can prove that the employer knew or should have known about the alleged act of harassment and didn't do anything about it to remedy the situation. On the other hand, under settled Supreme Court law, where an act of harassment is committed by a so-called supervisor and where there's a tangible employment action taken against the employee or committed against the employee by that supervisor, such as demotion, firing, transferring, some significant employee action, that employer, if it's done by a supervisory employee, will be absolutely liable without any kind of defense. If there's no tangible employment action taken, in other words, there may be an act of harassment, but where it doesn't result in a serious employment action, such as demotion or transfer or firing, that employer will have a defense. And that defense is, number one, if it's exercised reasonable care to prevent and correct any of the harassing behavior, and two, where the plaintiff or the employee who's complaining about the act of harassment failed to take advantage of an existing anti-harassment policy promulgated and communicated by the company. So again, let me just review for you before I get to the decision. The traditional law is where an act of harassment is committed by a rank-and-file employee against another rank-and-file employee, the employer is only liable if the employee can show negligence on the part of the employer. On the other hand, where there's a tangible action committed against an employee by a supervisor, that employer will be absolutely liable without a defense. And even if it doesn't result in a tangible employment action, the employer only has a defense if it has an existing policy against harassment and the employee did not adequately use or utilize that policy. What was undefined until the case of Vance versus Ball State University was what constitutes a supervisor. Is a supervisor akin in Title VII law to simply a lead worker or somebody who may give orders to another employee? Or is a supervisor under Title VII established by a higher standard, somebody who has real impact on the employment situation involving an employee? This decision that was handed down on Monday was written by Justice Alito, and it was joined by Chief Justice Roberts, Scalia, Kennedy, and Thomas. And as you might imagine, the liberal bloc of the court, which consists of Ginsburg, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan, were dissenting votes in this case. Nevertheless, in a very, very significant decision, the Supreme Court under Justice Alito decided that in any kind of a Title VII case, the employer would only be held liable in the absolute sense if the supervisor who is alleged to have committed the offense is empowered by the employer to take tangible employment actions against the victim in a very material and substantial way. And as the court indicates, and I'll read this to you, we hold that an employer may be vicariously liable for an employee's unlawful harassment only when the employer has empowered that employee to take tangible employment actions against the victim, i.e., to effect a significant change in employment status, such as hiring, firing, failing to promote, reassignment with significantly different responsibilities, or a decision causing a significant change in benefits. So, what the Supreme Court has stated is that it'll be more difficult for an employee to basically allege and successfully prove a case of workplace harassment involving a so-called supervisor unless that employee can demonstrate that that person who he's calling a supervisor is imbued with very significant authority, the authority to hire or fire or fail to promote or reassign with significantly different decisions or a decision causing a significant change in benefits. So for those of you who have any EEO responsibilities, I think that you should be heartened by this decision. It was not really a surprise to me given the current composition of the court. The other significant part about this case and the next case that I'm going to mention is you may remember in my last telebrief, I talked about the EEOC's so-called guidance on criminal background checks. And I indicated in my discussion in the last telebrief that many times the EEOC's regulations and rules and guidances don't get the degree of deference from courts that they might like to obtain. Now, in this case, not only did the Supreme Court buck the EEOC's position on what a supervisor is, but it also negated the EEOC's guidance on its definition of what a supervisor is as well. So in a footnote, the court says, the United States urges us to defer to the EEOC guidance, but to do so would be proper only if the EEOC guidance has the power to persuade, which depends upon the thoroughness evident in its consideration, the validity of its reasoning, and its consistency with earlier and later pronouncements. For the reasons explained below, we do not find the EEOC guidance persuasive. To me, this is a very significant aspect of not only this case, Vance versus Ball State University, but the next case that I'm going to discuss as well. So, as I stated 2 weeks ago, just because the EEOC puts out regulations or rules or a guidance doesn't necessarily give it the force of law when it comes to how they will be interpreted by a federal court. And in this case, the Supreme Court actually slapped the hand of the EEOC and said, we're not paying attention to your guidance because we don't think that it makes a lot of sense. Now, the second case that I'm going to decide, that I'm going to mention, was decided again on June 24th of this year, 2 days ago, decided by the Supreme Court in a case called University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center versus Nassar, N-A-S-S-A-R. And the major issue in this case had to do with the standard under which an employee who claims a retaliation case must prove in order to successfully promulgate or successfully prosecute his retaliation claim. And essentially what happened here was there was an individual named Nassar who filed both substantive claims against the University Medical Center on the basis that he had been discriminated against on the basis of his religion and national origin or ethnic heritage. And then he coupled that with a claim of retaliation. The case wound up in court, in a lower court, which found for him and awarded him $400,000 in back pay and more than $3 million in compensatory damages. The district court reduced that compensatory damage award to $300,000. The case wound its way through the Court of Appeals, Federal Court of Appeals, and eventually got to the Supreme Court on what the appropriate test is for in assessing whether there has been actionable retaliation. And the differences are these. The plaintiff in this case recovered on the basis that one of the motivating factors behind the employer's decision to terminate him was a retaliatory motive for his earlier filing of an EEOC complaint. The other standard, which the Supreme Court has adopted, is the so-called but-for test, which is a more stringent test. And essentially what it says is this, that in any case brought in federal court or under the EEOC's Title VII, where an employee is alleging that he or she has been the victim of not only substantive discrimination, but retaliation on top of discrimination. And as you know, in fiscal year 2012-2013, there were about 100,000 charges filed with the EEOC. Fully one-third of them consisted of retaliation charges. So retaliation is often piggybacked on substantive EEOC charges. And what the Supreme Court said in the Nassar case just 2 days ago was that in order for an employee to successfully prosecute a claim for retaliation, he must show that but for the employer's knowing that the employee had engaged in a protected act of filing a charge, that the act, so-called act of retaliation, would not have taken place. It's a much more stringent standard than simply saying that a motivating factor behind the employer's decision was retaliatory in nature. So here, the Supreme Court laid out a scenario in the context of its decision, which I think is very instructive for those of you who face these kinds of situations. So what the Supreme Court said in its decision was, in addition, lessening the causation standard could also contribute to the filing of frivolous claims, which would siphon resources from efforts by employer, administrative agencies, and courts to combat workplace harassment. Consider in this regard, the case of an employee who knows that he or she is about to be fired for poor performance, given a lower pay grade, or even just transferred to a different assignment or location. To forestall that lawful action, he or she might be tempted to make an unfounded charge of racial, sexual, or religious discrimination. Then, when the unrelated employment action comes, the employee could allege that it is retaliation. If respondent, meaning employer, could allege that it is retaliation, if respondent were to prevail in his argument here, that claim could be established by a lessened causation standard, all in order to prevent the undesired change in employment circumstances. Even if the employer could escape judgment after trial, the lessened causation standard would make it far more difficult to dismiss dubious claims at the summary judgment stage. Essentially, what the court is saying here is what you all may face, frankly, in a practical sense, which is you have situations where an employee may have complained or even filed a charge of discrimination. They do that in a preemptive fashion because they know that they're on thin ice, either because of bad performance or conduct, etc. And they believe that because they have filed a charge or a complaint, that they are therefore immunized by any kind of further adverse or negative action on the part of the employer. What the Supreme Court has expressly said in the Nassar case is that that employee will only get the protection of the anti-retaliatory provisions of Title VII by showing that but for his act of filing a charge or filing a claim, that the employer would not have taken the action it did, which is a much more lenient standard for an employer to meet than would be the standard of a motivating factor behind the employer's retaliatory action was the fact that the employee had previously filed a charge or a complaint. So both of these cases, Vance versus Ball State University and University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center versus Nassar, filed by the Supreme Court on the very same day, are extremely pro-employer. And Justice Ginsburg was thoroughly annoyed at the both decisions, wrote over 20-page dissenting opinions under both decisions, and basically said that, in her opinion, Congress should take both of these decisions up and change the law in Title VII to accommodate her view of the law as opposed to the majority's view of the law. I doubt very much, given the present composition of Congress, that that will happen. So at least I know many times in these telebriefs I kind of give you difficult news. This is news emanating from the highest court in the land 2 days ago, very favorable towards employers, both in terms of the retaliation aspect and, frankly, the definition of supervisor under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. I want to mention another thing that's come up to me a couple times in the last month, and that is an issue under the Fair Labor Standards Act, particularly as it pertains to technology today. We all have smartphones, we all use email on our phones, and we all have access to work networks probably while we're driving or while we're texting or while we're at home, et cetera. I want to bring up an issue that's come up with a couple of my clients that may come up with you as well, and that is there is no issue when exempt employees work on the weekend or work off hours in answering emails or responding or using the work network to be responsive to a supervisor or a boss or something like that in terms of work time, because we, as we all know, exempt employees are paid the same whether they work 30 hours a week or 80 hours a week, and whether they are answering emails at night or on the weekend, et cetera. That's not the case for non-exempt employees. So if you have distributed smartphones or cell phones to non-exempt employees, or in fact, if you give non-exempt employees access to your work network, you have to be careful about expecting or condoning or permitting non-exempt employees to be considered working, in quotation marks, by answering or responding to emails off hours, weekends, or nights, because that time can well be considered by the Department of Labor as work time. So you need to take a look at your policies. You need to take a look at how you keep track of time, and if you expect employees to be responsive off hours, particularly non-exempt employees, you're going to have to figure out either how to track time or how to prohibit the access of those employees to a work network during off hours. Otherwise, the Department of Labor, were it to audit your policies, would very likely find that to be work time. And there have been several recent cases involving big corporations like T-Mobile and Black & Decker where FLSA collective actions have been brought by non-exempt employees on the basis that the employer did not compensate them for hours that were worked or time that was worked in the form of answering or responding to emails during time that wouldn't be their typical work hours. So just a word to the wise, take a look at that. If you are allowing your employees to do that, you need to make sure that you have policy statements on that or that you have a method of tracking that time. The last thing that I'll mention to you is I did say, and I know I've covered this in the past, that the EEOC is looking very carefully at hiring practices of companies as part of its strategic plans for 2013 and 2014 and beyond. And I know that the EEOC announced on Monday a lawsuit against, in Baltimore, in federal court against a company called Performance Food Group, Inc., on the basis that the company was engaged in an ongoing pattern of refusing to hire women for positions at the company's distribution facilities. The lawsuit says that the positions included such jobs as drivers, forklift operators, mechanics, transportation supervisors, and warehouse supervisors. Again, as I've indicated, you got to make sure that you're not stereotyping positions as male or female, or that you're not guiding any particular gender into any particular classification that you might have, because this is very high on the EEOC's radar screen at the present time. So those are the topics for today. If there are any questions, be glad to answer them. If not, Jeannie, when's the next telebrief?
The next telebrief will be the second Wednesday of August, which will be, oh my goodness, wait a minute. Then the second Wednesday would be the 14th.
Okay. So, again, as I always say, if you have private questions, feel free to call me on my work line, 410-209-6417, or my work email, hkerman, H-K-U-R-M-A-N, at Offit Kurman, OFFITKURMAN.com. I appreciate everybody's participation as usual, and I hope everybody has a good week, and at least we got some good news from the Supreme Court on Monday.
Howard, so, can I just jump in real quickly and just say some people have asked about our executive sessions. We'll be resuming in the fall. We'll do two, probably October and early November, and you should be receiving information on that, details and topics, in August. And also, many of you have requested blocks of pins so that other members of your team can listen in. So I just wanted to mention that we are happy to do that. If you want other members of your team to have a pin, just please email me. For those who don't know it, my email address is jhyatt, J-H-Y-A-T-T, at offitkurman, one word, O-S-F-I-T-K-U-R-M-A-N.com. Thanks, Howard.
Okay, sure. All right, everybody. Have a good day.
Howard.
Thank you. Bye.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Question, please.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, sure.
Howard, this is Bob Kamer.
Hey, Bob.
Hey. You mentioned about the going back to the Vance versus Ball State.
Yeah.
You mentioned that if the harassment occurred with no employment action taken, the employer has a defense. And what's that defense again?
The defense is that it has promulgated and communicated a clear policy on workplace harassment. In other words, there's probably a handbook policy on what employees can do to remedy harassment, and
okay.
that the employee did not take full advantage of it.
Okay. All right. And then the second question is Gene said that the next one is August. We're skipping July completely?
No. We're not skipping July. She misspoke. It'll be the second Wednesday in July.
Which will be the 10th of July. Okay.
10th of July. You got it.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Yep.
All righty. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.